This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Well, I'm going to talk about the field of paleoneurology, specifically as it pertains to human ancestors. And I'll begin by talking about it in its traditional sense, which is very easy to understand. Paleoneurologists, as we're called, study basically two kinds of information in order to think about cognitive evolution, and they both come from skulls. The first thing they look at is brain size, and the way they estimate that is by taking a volume of the inside of the brain case. This is called a cranial capacity. And on the right, you see a skull. It's from something called Homo floresiensis, and it has had a virtual endocast prepared by an engineer. It's this red endocast, and it shows a lot of details of the surface of the brain, and that's the second kind of information. So you can get the volume of the brain case by either virtually or measuring it with seeds, and then you can take a cast of the interior to get an endocast and look for information about the surface of the brain that maybe with luck was imprinted on that endocast. So let's take a look at these two things. To begin with, brain size. Here we have 3.5 million years of time going from the left up to the present on the right. This is called the Stone Age. And watch the bouncing balls. You will see what happened to brain size or cranial capacity through time. As you can see, it increased. In fact, increased on average more than three times. So we know that throughout the Stone Age, the last roughly 3.5 million years, the brains of our ancestors increased in size. That's one major piece of information, and there's lots of ways you can analyze it. The second thing, endocasts. Here we have the right side of an endocast from a little skull called Tong that you saw in the first slide. And this was the first australopithecine ever discovered. And I just want you to see what kinds of information you might pick up off an endocast. And you see here the blue lines represent grooves in the brain that separates convolutions. These are called sulci. And you also can get information about blood vessels and about the sutures of the skull where it knit together. So one hopes to pick up some of these details of sulcar patterns, but it's touch and go. But that's the second major kind of information paleoneurologists traditionally obtain from skulls. So what do we want to know? We would like to know how a brain, something like a chimpanzee brain, eventually evolved into a brain like a human brain. And you're looking at schematics of the left sides of the brains of chimpanzee on the left, the human on the right, and we want to see what's different with the human. Well, you can see right away the brain's a lot bigger. We already noted that. But also, most of the sulci, most of the convolutions look very, very similar. There are, however, two places in the brain where you do have distinctive sulcal patterns between chimps and humans. One's in the frontal lobe, where you have this red groove here, which is a particular sulcus. And in the human, you have two little sulci instead of this great big sulcus. In the human, this area is very important. It's called Broca's speech area. So the front of the brain is a place we like to learn about, if possible, from endocasts. But the biggest interest in the past over 100 years has been in the back of the brain. And you see on the chimpanzee here, this big red groove, it's shaped like a crescent. That's called the lunate sulcus. And it's in front of an area which we have a little 17 on. That represents Brodmann's area 17, which is primary visual cortex. So in monkeys and apes, you've got this very drama in the back end of the brain. You've got this big lunate sulcus, which separates, which is in front of the visual cortex. In humans, however, when you look at the back of the brain, you don't see a red groove there. Often, you don't even see signs of the primary visual cortex on the outside surface of the brain in the back. Instead, area 17 in humans is deeper around, more towards the middle of the brain, and it may or may not encroach on the outside surface. But in any event, it does not have a lunate sulcus in front of it. And this has been a bone of contention for a long time, whether or not humans have a lunate sulcus in the posterior part of the brain.
In 2006, John Allen and his colleagues did a study on a lot of human brains looking for the lunate sulcus, and they studied it at a very finite level, very nitty-gritty level, and determined that, in fact, humans do not have this big crescent-shaped sulcus in front of the primary visual cortex. So then that raises the question, what happened to the lunate sulcus during the course of a hominid evolution? And my colleagues, Christopher Zollicoffer and Marcia Ponce de Leon, and I have just published an article in Anatomical Record where we offer a hypothesis that we think accounts for what happened to the lunate sulcus. And we actually rely on very old research that's in the literature, including Gratiolet in 1854. This is a monkey brain. You're looking at a schematic of the left side. And here he's cut into the lunate sulcus. Now, ordinarily, that lunate sulcus, when you see that big C shape on the surface, it's covering up the depth of the sulcus itself, which goes deep into the brain. And by covering up, the fancy word for that is opercularizes. Operculum refers to a lid. So they've cut away the operculum, and you can see there are four sulci here that hook the parietal lobe and the temporal lobe to the occipital lobe behind. We're interested in the first one and the second one. These are connecting little gyri, little tiny convolutions that connect to the occipital region within the lunate sulcus of monkeys and apes. You're looking at chimp brains, real chimp brains on the right image with MRI. And you can see that one and two are color-coded here. They're peeking out of the lunate sulcus. One is the orange, two is the blue. So they're down within the sulcus, as they are in monkeys, but just a little bit peeks out on the top. And what they're doing is, within the depths of the sulcus, connecting the parietal with the green occipital lobes behind. Here is, again, the same image of the monkey. And if you look at a human brain, this is an actual human brain, we have these same connecting gyri or arcs, one and two. And what they do in the human is they connect out to great big gyri that are on the surface of the occipital lobe. One is going from the parietal to the occipital lobe down into the clear down to the bottom of the occipital lobe. Two is doing the same thing. They have a particular configuration. So here we have, again, these are human brains. And just to show you, in a human brain, you can see the orange and the blue, but we've shown here where, in fact, they're connecting, again, with the purple. They're flowing out from one lobe, the parietal, to the occipital and blending with the convolutions of the occipital lobe. All right. So an implication of this work is that these, during evolution, these little gyri that were deep within the sulcus actually expanded up onto the surface of the whole brain and flowed over, if you will, into the occipital region and gave rise to these human convolutions of the occipital lobe. And so instead of the lunate sulcus, which doesn't exist, covering the deep sulcus, it actually was overflowed and gave rise to these gyri. So no longer do we have a lunate sulcus that's opercularizing the depth of the sulcus. And so the what we think happened is that these connecting gyri swelled up to the surface and then they de-opercularized. They actually created or evolved into new big convolutions on the brain that covered up and that lunate sulcus and that it was gone. And this follows the work, very important work of Jean-Francois Mangin, 2019, the reference is on top, where he hypothesized that sulci are kind of hotbeds that give rise to seeding developing cortex. And so we very much appreciate that work. And to give you a visual, is that we think that the lunate sulcus, which is also known as the Offenspalte, meaning eight sulcus, that it actually turned itself inside out during the course of evolution, connecting or continuing to connect parietal with new parts of occipital lobes, which it was creating on the surface. And Christoph Zollicoffer said, aha, it deopercularized what used to be the lunate sulcus. So he coined that term. All right. So we think that's what's happened to the lunate sulcus. We applied it to the fossil record to hominids that lived 1.8 million years ago in the Republic of Georgia, a Demonaceae. Here they're endocast. And we think on the endocast, we actually see little signs of these little connecting gyri as they're coming to the surface. And so we concluded in that these arcs, as we call them, these orange and blue little gyri, they're occipital arcs, that they came out of the lunate sulcus in the process of uncovering or deopercularizing the lunate sulcus as brains enlarge. And this fits with other work that Ponce de Leon did in 2021 and suggests to us that the Demonaceae fossils were living at a time of reorganization of the brain, and we're actually seeing it within and speculating about what's going on in the depths of the sulci, that is reorganization within the brain itself. Okay, so we've talked about endocasts and the debate about endocasts and brain size for 3.5 million years, but there's a problem. And the problem is this: hominids have been evolving for twice that long. We know from genetic data and fossil record, but particularly genetic data, that we share a most recent common ancestor with chimps that lived 5 to 7 million years ago. So we don't have the left half of this graph. And it's important to think about, you know, what was going on cognitively with evolution before you get that brain size we see taking off during the Stone Age. I call this time, this first 3.5 million years, the Botanic Age. And briefly, I call it that because I think that botanic matter was very, very important for the seeding of an evolution of cognition. I think it started with something invented by great apes, which is sleeping, arboreal sleeping nests. And Barbara Frost has actually suggested this was a kickoff for cognitive evolution. And I think she was right. I think of these as baskets and trees, and then talk about how knowing how to make them translated into baskets on the hips, namely baby swings. And eventually we have baskets on the ground for sleeping during the Botanic Age, which is the first whatever up to 3.5 million. You can go back to 7 to 3.5, the Botanic Age. And also I trace what's known as a rotten archaeological record, but we do have a little bit of a material record for botanical tools beginning about 7,800 years ago with a polished plank from Israel. And you see things come into the record. A biggie is 2,000 years ago, you get paper and then you have memory. But what I want to know is more about the brain and what happened to the brain itself. And so I'm going to briefly describe what I call an extended paleoneurological synthesis, EPS, where we can't just look at skulls and cranial capacities anymore because we don't have them. So how do we ask these questions? We need to look at comparative primatology, both skeletal and behavior. We need to look at evo-devo babies, you know, and fetuses growing up, chimpanzees and people, and think about that. And right now I'm very much immersed in thinking about locomotion. And particularly, but not exclusively, bipedalism. And what I think we need to ask is, what is it that we people do today that other primates do not do? And there are two things that come to mind. One is that we can keep a beat let's say, to music, to any regular or any rhythm that we hear that comes in. We can keep a beat, we can dance, we can tap to it in a way that great apes and monkeys can't. They have a little bit but of ability, but nothing like humans. And we have grammatical language where we can express an endless number of ideas. And so my colleague, Mats Larsson, actually came up with the prenatal rhythmic hypothesis in 2019, which is very important for asking, you know, how did we get the ability to keep a beat? And he suggested that pregnant hominid women who walked bipedally, which we see evolving very gradually, walked in a new way, which were the footsteps, produced a beat. Fetuses heard the footsteps, which fetuses do through amniotic fluid, and they felt the movements accompanying the footsteps, and that this was the basis that stimulated a synthesis of the nervous processing of what one hears and what one feels, and that and movement, and that that was the foundation that led to way, way, way more recently, eventually was adapted by Mother Nature, if you will, and formed the foundations for keeping a beat to music. So it wasn't just pregnant mothers, it's also thinking of bipedal feet. They go from being, you know, a foot like this to we have a foot like this, and that had to have made a huge difference. Yes, it meant mothers could walk in a bipedal way eventually, and fetuses could hear them. But also it meant that fetuses would no longer be able to hang on to their mothers, as all monkeys and apes do. They hang on with four limbs to their traveling mothers. Hominids lost that grasping foot. Our babies don't do that. And that as a result, that this had a dramatic impact on hominid evolution, namely little newborns and very young infants who would ordinarily still be riding on their mothers under their own steam, hanging on, would have fallen off. And this is something primates don't like, to be separated from their mothers. And David Lindsay, in fact, wrote a beautiful paper in which he noted that if hominid infants ceased to be able to cling to their mother's underbellies as a result of bipedalism, there was likely a protracted phylogenetic phase during which infants held on to their mothers more tenuously. And he studied reflexes of infant humans and infant non-human primates and thought about what that meant for motor evolution. And there are examples from good old chimpanzees of how falling off the mother can be fatal. An illustration of that where because of a polio epidemic, Madam B could no longer assist her infants, and they fell off and one of her babies died from the wounds. So Mats Larsson and I put these together, thinking about keeping a beat, the importance not just for for the eventual evolution and emergence of musical abilities and dancing and clapping in time, but also you need to be able to keep a beat, that is, entrain to outside sounds in order to have language, in order to develop language. And so we see evolving bipedalism having an effect on the fetuses. The feet are already changing because bipedalism is happening. Fetuses are falling from their mothers. I think that was a stimulus for interactions between mothers and infants based on vocalizations that a long time, you know, into the future gave rise eventually to motherese or proto-motherese, which gave rise eventually to language. So we see the bipedalism, the changes in feet, the changes on the fetuses over lots and lots of time. This is not to scale. Way later, being the seeds that were available for natural selection to pick up on. And then you get these sort of group behaviors that are musical once you have communities that settle down in places. And eventually you get music and language, and that the two are closely related. So we hypothesize that during the Botanic Age, slow selection for bipedalism had a direct effect on hominid fetuses
and infants that stimulated the more recent emergence of a drived ability to keep a beat, and further, that this ability was eventually exacerbated during the coevolution of music and language. I don't have time to go into it now, but we published this in Current Anthropology. There were people who commented on it, and we have suggestions for ways to begin to test this hypothesis. I will tell you that a researcher in Tokyo, Gentaro Taga, is doing MRI imaging of fetuses and studying their motor development. And this is the future. This is an important technique, and it's rapidly developing. So we expect there will be future findings that will be related to this hypothesis that we put out. So I'll just end by saying people argue about, well, was there one thing that was responsible for the evolution of cognition in hominids? And I would say we've given you some seeds, okay? Keeping a beat's necessary. But I think the thing for me would be the combination of musical abilities and language. If anything drove the evolution, I think it was language, because that's something we do in a way no other animal does. And you can't say that for a lot of the other prime movers that have been suggested. So I just want to end by thanking Carter very much for the opportunity to talk with you, and also a nod to those prehistoric mothers and infants for evolving as they did, or we wouldn't be here today as we are. So thank you very much, and I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.